Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we remember jazz pianist Dave Brubeck, who died yesterday at the age of 91, one day shy of his 92nd birthday. Brubeck is one of the most popular and prolific musicians in the history of jazz. His compositions number in the hundreds, from jazz standards like In Your Own Sweet Way, The Duke, and Blue Rondo a la Turk, to sacred music, oratorios, and symphonic works. Through the 1950s and 60s, the Dave Brubeck Quartet with saxophonist Paul Desmond and drummer Joe Morello was one of the most popular groups in all of popular music, and their 1959 recording, Time Out, has remained a top-selling jazz recording to this day. That recording best reflected Brubeck's compositional interest in unconventional time signatures, combining classical compositional elements into jazz, and multi-tonalities. Here's a sampling of one of those most popular compositions, Blue Rondo a la Turk. The music of jazz pianist and composer Dave Brubeck, who died yesterday. After the quartet broke up in the 1960s, Brubeck increasingly worked with his talented musician sons, who are musicians and composers in their own right, Darius, Chris, and Michael. And when I spoke with him back in October of 1996, that was one of our first topics of conversation. Today we remember Dave Brubeck on Studio Tulsa. Do you remember the first time when you had one of your sons play with you on a concert? As musicians, you know that there are families that, you know, sometimes families can exploit other family members, you know, by forcing everybody in the family to get on stage from age two or three.
Yeah.
When did that decision occur, and what was your feeling about it the first time?
I can remember it very well, because I was playing in Poland in 1958, and they say that we were one of the first, maybe the first jazz group to go behind the Iron Curtain. And we were towards the end of the concert with Paul Desmond, Joe Morello, Eugene Wright. And I looked up, and here are two of my kids walking out on stage. And I'm wondering, what are they doing? And Darius came over and sat down on the piano bench next to me, and Michael went to the drums. And I said, get out of here. What are you doing? You know, I whispered to them. And they said, okay. And they got up and left. Pretty quick, they came back. And I said, what are you doing out here? And he said, well, the person that's putting on the concert is saying that we should come out and play. And I said, oh, my God. We've never done this before, you know. And I said to Darius, well, what do you want to play? And he said, take the A train. So I said, okay, you get up on the treble part, because he was on the bass part of the piano. Right? And he started to play. Right away, he started to improvise. And I whispered to him, play the melody. And so he tried to get back on the melody, because he thought he should get out there and improvise. He was 12 years old, maybe 10 years old. So after the concert, the reporters were backstage, and there were some from Germany had come to this concert. It was our first concert in Poland. And the German man said, what did your father say to you? And he said, play the melody, stupid. And so the next day I saw the headlines from the German paper, and it said, Spielen der Melody Dummkopf. So that was our first experience as a family group.
You mentioned your son, Darius. Of course, he's named for the French composer, Darius Milhaud, who you studied with.
Right.
Take us back in your history. You studied with Milhaud. Did he have a profound
influence? Oh, yeah. Still does.
Uh-huh.
You know, he was the first classical composer, they say, in classical European music to use the jazz idiom in a piece called Creation of the World. And apparently it's before Gershwin did some of his things and before other composers like Ravel and Debussy used the jazz idiom. You're never sure, you know, who did it first, but you can absolutely say he was the one that used it the most. And Creation of the World, according to Leonard Bernstein, is still the best combination of jazz and classical music. It's a wonderful piece. And I was drawn to him because of this. And my brother, Howard, was his assistant at Mills College. And I came to study with him before I went in the Army. If I survived World War II, I told him I would definitely come back. And I did survive, although I was in Patton's Army. It's kind of difficult to think that you're going to make it all the way. And so I went right back on the GI Bill and studied with him for 3 years.
You know, Milhaud as much as anybody, but all of what I would call the French-inspired composers, from Stravinsky, who I would consider a French-inspired composer, to all the Lesiques, they saw the possibilities of jazz early. Did you ever ask Milhaud about that? Why?
Yeah.
Yeah. What did he tell you?
He thought jazz saved European art.
Really?
Outside of that, he didn't think much of it.
He urged you to start performing jazz. I guess you wanted to be a classical composer, or what we can call a West European?
I was primarily a jazz musician.
Mm-hmm. Even then?
Oh, sure. And I wanted to study with him to learn how to compose, be a composer. And he said, definitely never lose your jazz influence and background. He said, that's so important. And if you lose that, you'll never represent America. And you always want to represent your own country.
Hmm. Musical nationalism, even then. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, tell us, you started with the octet. And eventually, the classic Brubeck quartet of Joe Morello, Eugene Wright, and Paul Desmond came together. How did that quartet form?
Well, you're leaving out the trio.
Just the trio, that's right. Okay, the trio.
Which was the rhythm section of the octet, and together for 2 years with Cal Jader and Ron Crotty. And we were playing in Honolulu, and I got in a swimming accident, which came close to paralyzing me. And so the trio did dissolve at that point, and I had to stay in the hospital a month, and then took a long time. They wanted to keep me in the hospital a lot longer, but I wanted to get out of there. The doctor said, I'll let you out if you promise to go right back to Waikiki Beach, where you got injured, and swim hours every day, because that will help you get back in shape more than practically anything we can do in the hospital. But you've got to promise to do that. You should promise to swim every chance you get the rest of your life. And I still do that a lot. And by the trio breaking up, I wrote to Paul Desmond from the hospital and told him we should form a quartet. And that's how the quartet started. It was from an accident.
You'd known Paul Desmond for many years, I guess.
Right.
When the two of you first meet, and people always talk about this wonderful relationship you had through your music, and I guess as friends as well, but how did that come about?
When I was going overseas, I had a friend, Dave Van Crete, who played in the octet, was in a band at the Presidio in San Francisco, and I very much wanted to get into that band rather than go overseas in the infantry. And Paul was one of the people that they had me come to a recreation hall, they called them, rec room, where there was a piano, and play and sit in with these guys that were in that band. And Paul's first impression of me was I was stark raving mad because I started playing in two keys at once and he didn't know what was going on. And our initial relationship was that he'd always come in and try to sit in with various groups I was in. And then he formed a group of his own where he hired the bass player and the girl singer from the group I was in, and was going to, that would have broken up that group. So I went along with the idea that that would be a group. And Paul was the leader. And then he got a job up in Feather River in California. It was kind of a more commercial job, and so he wanted a more commercial piano player. So he took off and left me holding the bag, and I had two kids and a wife. And so I told my wife, I never want to see this guy again the rest of my life. If he ever comes around, don't let him in the house. So we struggled, and I didn't have any job, and the guy wanted to hire me where Paul left. I was going to get Bill Smith and another bass player. And Paul said, no, this is my job. And when I get through with the summer job, I want to come back here. And I don't want you taking my job. So I was just totally out of work. And I went to work finally for another band leader at a place called Clear Lake, California. While we were working there, Jimmy Lyons, who was a disc jockey on NBC and ran the Monterey Festival, said, look, I've got a job for you for a trio. Do you want it? And I said, boy, do I want it. I want to get out of here. So that was the beginning of the trio. And then Paul heard the trio when he was in New York. You remember Jack Fina's band? Paul and Herb Geller, do you know that name?
Yes, Herb Geller. I'm familiar with that.
And they were sitting next to each other in the sax section. But Paul heard the trio recordings on a radio show in New York, and he quit Jack Fina and came right back to San Francisco and just bugged everybody.
So he bugged you until you gave him a job?
Well, he came to the house, and I had told my wife, don't even let him in. And so she let him in because she always liked Paul and the way he played and the way we played together. So that's the way part of the reconciliation came. And then when I got hurt, I wrote to Paul and said, you know, let's form a quartet like you've always wanted to.
And, of course, that quartet made history, the classic album Time Out. And of course, Take Five was the first million-selling jazz single. It's been said when that song and that album was inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame, it said that single probably turned more people onto jazz than any other single recording in the history of jazz.
And it still does. It's still one of the biggest sellers on Columbia Records. And that's a real phenomenon in this business, to have something last from 1958 is when we started playing Time Out till today.
Was that the first experiment with the unusual time signatures that have really become your signature? You've been doing that?
We started that with the octet, and that the public wasn't ready for it. And there's hints of it with the trio, things in 6-4 and a piece called I Didn't Know What Time It Was. It's an old standard tune, and
right,
I messed that all up. So
so really nobody knew what time it was.
Yeah, and I'm in a dancing mood with the trio. So we were hitting with this, with the trio, and Cal Jader was such a great drummer that he could do these odd time signatures. And my next drummer was a great drummer, but he didn't want to get near the odd time signatures. So it was when Joe Morello joined the group that he can do anything. He's just a time machine. Then I said to myself, boy, I've got a drummer where I can start doing all this. And I never featured a drummer like I featured Joe. And the first night he did a drum solo in his life was with me on a piece called Sounds of the Loop. And when the set was over, well, Paul walked off the bandstand, went to the dressing room and said, "You got to fire that guy." And I said, "No." He said, "Well, either he goes or I go." And I said, "Well, he's not going." So the next day we were doing our records session for Columbia, and Paul and Norman Bates stood outside the glass but wouldn't come in. They were in the control room. So Joe and I played alone for 3 hours. Nothing ever happened much with that. And then that night I expected to be just Joe and I on the stand, piano and drums. And Paul walked in kind of sheepishly and went up on the bandstand because he knew I wasn't going to fire Joe. Wow. And they became great friends. Took a long time because Joe was somebody I featured every night because I consider him the greatest drummer that ever lived. And a lot of other people did too.
Well, I know among musician circles, they always talk about seeing Joe Morella at clinics, and he would beat 3 in 1 foot, 4 in the other, 5 in another, and 6.
He had this amazing ability
to...
He had absolute control of each of his feet and each of his hands to be separate. Like, I couldn't believe. That's why I wasn't going to let him go. I said, "My God, Joe, you can do all these things." And he said, "Yeah, well, let's do them." And he said, "You know, nobody else would ever give me a chance." And I said, "Boy, I'm going to feature you." And when we play a concert, there'd often be 20 drummers come up afterwards and talk to him. And then he started doing drum clinics where there'd be 500 drummers. And, you know, people forget how important he was and yeah. How important Gene Wright was and Paul Desmond. You know, it wasn't just Paul.
It was all four of you. It was an incredible quartet.
Yeah.
What led to the breakup? Was it a desire to do the extended compositions that you continue to do to this day?
You know, the guys didn't want to break up. I gave them a year's notice.
Uh-huh.
And they couldn't believe it because they had pulled so many fast ones on me. Eugene Wright never pulled anything on me. He was the greatest side man that ever lived. And often took care of me, you know. If things were tough and he saw I was worn out, he'd jump in and help. Because in those days, I didn't have a manager or somebody on the road to take care of all.
Yeah, anybody. It was just setting up the bandstand. And
And so Gene was great. And Joe and Paul could give me a hard time once in a while, and yet we all loved each other. You know, when you read about the Beatles or any successful group. And at the end of Paul's life, where he was dying, it was Joe that was so concerned and sent one of his drum students to live with Paul because Paul was a bachelor and was alone. And at that point in his life, he didn't want to be in the hospital. And his last concert, he got the doctors to give him blood transfusions. And he came out, and they thought he couldn't even walk on stage. We played at Lincoln Center in New York and with my sons and Paul. And he said, I want to play the last concert here in New York with you. It was real tough because we had become so close. And he was like an uncle to my children. They called him Uncle Paul. My son Darius said he thought he was his real uncle. He said, "He looked just like you." People got us confused, you know.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful. And Joe was so heartbroken when Paul passed away. So we were like the typical group that stays together. We were 17 years, I think, together with a quartet, and the other guys were 10 or 11 years. And you go through a lot because you're on stage every night together, you're in an airplane together or a bus, and you're in a hotel. And you see more of these guys than you do of your wife. And it's tough to keep a relationship going that doesn't make it all fly apart. And it was the opposite way. We grew more and more fond of each other right to the end.
Well, when the quartet did disband and you began focusing on different forms of music, the cantatas, the oratorios, one of the senses that really has stuck with me about that work is this sense of spirituality that's been a part of it. You kind of allude to a different sort of spirituality, the comradeship among fellow musicians, but the religious spirituality, I'm thinking of to the creator. I want to ask you about that influence on you as a jazz musician. You don't hear that talked about much among most jazz musicians. How is the religious, the spirituality that you feel come out in your music?
Well, with the guys that I have been close to in jazz, there have been such wonderful spiritual giants like Duke Ellington, who devoted a lot of his life to writing sacred music, and Mary Lou Williams wrote a mass, and Billy Taylor's written a mass, and my friend that I've known since he was 18 years old, Vince Guaraldi, wrote a mass. And it goes on and on and on how many guys were really involved in spiritual music. And then when you start talking to, if you just limited it to singers and pianists, you'll discover that almost every pianist grew up in the church. Thelonious Monk's father was a preacher. The great Fats Waller was raised by a minister, and Fats played organ in the church. He was a wonderful classical organist. Nat Cole's father was a minister.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, how did you ever get interested in religion? Well, you grow up. My mother was a choir director,
mm-hmm.
and I started playing in church when I was 14, got a dollar every Sunday playing hymns. And then you get to the singers, just forget it. You know, almost every one of them grew up singing in a choir or were soloists in church. So it's just part of what your background has been. And mine was certainly one of with a very religious mother. I've just named a few. It goes, the yes. list goes on and on and on.
But for most of those, that's a part of their roots as far as their performing commercially. And there are exceptions. You mentioned Duke, and certainly there are others that have composed sacred music. A lot of these musicians, they have the church in their background. It's certainly a part of them. But what they put out as, you know, entertainer X or musician X tends to be on the secular side. What spurred that those compositions in you?
Mm-hmm. Well, when you get thrown into the infantry, you get very religious.
In Patton's army.
Yeah. And I started thinking then about we are fighting the Germans and the Italians, and the center of the Lutheran religion is Germany. The center of Catholicism is Italy, and certainly the United States is centered on Judeo-Christian upbringing. And nobody's listening to what they should have been taught. And if you would go to the Pentagon and quote Christ, they'd crucify you in the middle of the place, you know? Which is one of the greatest things he ever said was, love your enemies. Do good to those that hate you. And the Ten Commandments have a little sentence in there about thou shalt not kill. What are we all out here killing each other about? And in that war, 52 million people died related to that war. And it makes you think a lot about how have we missed all of our upbringing and out here just blowing each other apart. So I thought then about setting the Ten Commandments. I was 22 or 23 maybe even 21 when I was thinking about that. I didn't actually do anything about it until I was in my 40s. I think I had the... It takes a lot of nerve and a lot of belief and a lot of encouragement to write something for a full symphony orchestra. My first religious piece was going to be called The Temptations and Teachings of Christ. It turned out to be called The Light in the Wilderness, which is a lot shorter title. And it was recorded by the Cincinnati Symphony and got very good reviews from tough critics, from the Washington Post. Paul Hewn gave it a great review. And Time Magazine gave it a great review. So I felt very encouraged by that, and we recorded it. I decided then I would like to do more of that kind of work. So I've written 10 oratorios or cantatas, and probably will write some more.
Yeah. On a variety of themes. I know I perform La Fiesta del Pasado, which is based on a Christmas oratorio.
We did that in Vienna.
Uh-huh.
This December 6th, my birthday, when I was 75. We went from the London Symphony, which celebrated my birthday a couple days earlier, and then flew to Vienna and did La Fiesta there. And we do those every year someplace, like we just did the Mass in Oklahoma City.
Yeah, and this is your latest. It's called To Hope?
Yeah, the recording is wonderful, but the depth of what happened in Oklahoma just brought tears to my eyes. Even to talk about it is hard.
You were thinking very much about the bombing, obviously.
Oh, my goodness. And there were 8 different choirs from various churches. And everybody involved in those choirs had someone close to them to be lost. So the whole idea of forgiveness and hope that comes in the Mass was there. It was there in the audience, and it was there in the musicians were very moved. Everybody in that auditorium was relating, and you on stage can feel that. It was a performance that I don't think will ever be equaled.
How rare is that feeling when everybody is on absolutely the same wavelength?
It's hard to get to that. That's what you hope will happen at a performance. And when it does happen, it's like kicking into overdrive and you sail from then on. You're not trying to bring the audience along with you. They're along with you from the first piece, first section of what you're doing. And that's what you hope for.
Jazz pianist and composer Dave Brubeck speaking with us back in the fall of 1996. The pianist and composer died yesterday at the age of 91, one day shy of his 92nd birthday. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher.